Okay, so coming back to discuss extractive industries, and I think I'm handing over to Siobhan to introduce the discussion.
Good morning, everyone. We just have the one paper for you today on reserve and resource reporting. So, Agenda Paper 19A presents our research findings about current practice regarding the disclosure of reserve and resource information. We have not considered the merits of our research findings and whether we think they provide evidence that there is a problem that needs to be addressed by standard setting. We will provide the board with an analysis of all of our research findings when the board is asked to decide on the scope of the research project to replace or amend IFRS 6. Paragraphs 11 to 20 provide just a little bit of background information about what reserve and resource reporting actually is and who uses reserve and resource information. As discussed in paragraphs 21 to 25, our research findings indicate that most jurisdictions have regulatory requirements for entities with extractive activities that specify the use of a particular reserve and resource classification system. These classification systems generally do align with the widely accepted reserve and resource classification systems of CRISCO for minerals and PRMS for oil and gas. Paragraphs 26 to 28 discuss the disclosure of reserve and resource information outside the financial statements. In particular, our findings indicate that regulatory requirements for the disclosure of reserve and resource information outside of the financial statements can differ significantly between jurisdictions. Per paragraphs 29 to 33, users of financial statements rely on reserve and resource information, which is generally found outside the financial statements, to enhance their understanding of the financial statements of an entity with extractive activities. Feedback from users of financial statements also indicates that reserve and resource information disclosed often lacks comparability and consistency, both between entities within the same industry and between jurisdictions, which can affect their understanding of the financial statements. Overall, our research findings indicate that the reserve and resource classification systems that jurisdictions require extractive entities to use generally do align with the widely accepted reserve and resource classification systems of CRISCO and PRMS. However, the regulatory requirements for the disclosure of reserve and resource information prepared applying those classification systems can differ between jurisdictions. And with that, I will hand over to the board for questions and discussion. Thank you.
Okay, who wants to talk about reserve and resource information? Okay, second. Jing Chao.
Thank you, Sue. Thank you. First of all, I appreciate staff's research and the findings. I really appreciate that staff try very hard to reach out to engage different stakeholders to collect together the information with regard to the reserve and the resources classification systems and the current disclosure requirement. And particularly, they did a very good job to get the information specific disclosure requirement of 9 jurisdictions. I feel very helpful and very detailed, very informative and useful. Two comments. First is that about the definition of reserve and resources. I noticed that in 2010 discussion paper chapter two, the discussion mentioned the definition, the importance of the definition, but at that time it was not so straightforward because different jurisdictions adopted different concepts or different definition. And from my point of view, the definition of the reserve and the resources is really important if we are going to develop accounting standards in this area, not only related to disclosure, but also related to measurement and recognition and measurement. For example, as the paper mentioned, such as impairment and depreciation or unit of account in some area. And the starting point of those accounting treatments is whether we can have consistent definition of resource, reserve and resources. The good thing I noticed that in this paper, we found that since 2010, it seems that most of the jurisdictions have tried to align with align their definition of resources and reserves with world globally accepted concept. So that is, I think, a very good phenomenon, very good trend for us to develop, you know, a common or consistent definition, at least the principal consistent definition of reserve and resources. So this is, I think, a good a new message we got based on your research. This is, I think, very good for us to move forward on this project in the next step. Secondly, I noticed that there are a lot of detailed requirements of these nine jurisdictions about disclosure requirements of extracted activities. And those information also very useful. I also know that many biggest oil and gas companies listed in US, you know, stock exchanges. So I noticed that on the current US requirement, that is on the, I think on page 36 and 37, SEC do require companies to disclose so-called supplemental information, supplementary information, particularly the information on a standardized measure of NPV of proved reserve, proved reserved, but based on the two dimension. One is based on the past 12 months historical average price of those reserves, and another is based on 10% discount rate. So this is a rule, SEC's requirement, and all the companies listed in American stock exchange, they needed to disclose those information. But I feel a little bit surprised because sometimes, especially for oil and gas, the volatility of the price is very high at this moment. So sometimes the forward-looking price is quite different from historical 12 months price. And also this discount rate, particularly at this moment, the negative, your low discount, your interest rate environment, but the SEC requirement is that they require entity to use, you know, 10% discount rate. It's very higher than current market rate. So the question I have is that when you do outreach, especially engage with the users, whether there are any feedback we got from users about the concerns of the usefulness of those information based on the past, you know, 12 months historical price based on the 10% discount rate, and based on those you know, element and the disclosed information about the net present value of the proved you know, reserves, whether there are any concerns about this information, or whether there are any improvement, you know, we need to think about of this requirement. Required information.
When we were doing our outreach specifically, we didn't really ask about, I guess, the usefulness of reserve and resource information at that level of detail. We looked at it in terms of how useful it is when you look at a set of financial statements. So with regards to specific requirements that the US has about its disclosures and presenting NPVs and discount rates and volatilities in price, we've not asked specific questions about how useful those particular pieces of information are. but it's definitely something we can consider as part of our scoping discussion.
Thank you.
Daryl?
So at the risk of displaying some naivety coming through with the question with the question I'm about to ask on this particular industry, I think from some of the previous work we've done, and particularly the work we've been doing with the four countries, and even some of the expanded work we've done beyond that, I had kind of come to the impression that there was actually quite a lot of consistency in the type of information that was being provided and how it was being prepared, and that there was something of an international consensus about the need for this information, albeit with what I might term subtle jurisdictional differences. In reading the research on the 177 jurisdictions and then even on the deep dive into the nine, a takeaway for me out of this paper is while there is consensus about the need for information, there is not as much consistency as I might have been thinking before this. And perhaps, Siobhan and Tim, a question for you guys was whether this was in line with what you'd expected going into those two elements of the research.
It's certainly, I think when I started this research, I had the assumption that everything would be different everywhere, because the discussion paper did, go into a little bit of detail about how different the requirements were in each jurisdiction. But I think the important thing to note from our research and from our outreach as well is that jurisdictions are really trying to gain that consistency, especially when it comes to, the recognition and measurement type of requirements in the codes. And it's where the disclosure is really different. So we're finding consistency, like Jin Chao said, in terms of the definitions lining up, but the consistency disappears almost when we get to disclosure. So we're finding that jurisdictions that really have large extractive industries, that have economies that rely significantly on extractive activities, they have a lot more detailed regulatory requirements about what needs to be disclosed. And then the smaller jurisdictions that we looked at that don't have such large industries, that aren't reliant on extractive activities, they don't have as well-developed disclosure requirements or regulatory requirements.
I think also I'd just add to what Siobhan's saying there as well is obviously what this shows is what the regulatory requirements are in a particular jurisdiction that a company has to follow. But I think there is an element of the industry, even if in their particular jurisdiction they don't have a particular requirement to disclose this information, there is an element of some, for example, in oil and gas, some of the big oil and gas companies, they would generally be disclosing their reserve information, and therefore, and that's something obviously we can explore further as we think about the scoping. But I think just because a jurisdiction doesn't require the information, it doesn't necessarily mean that companies might not disclose it, because they may well think in order to be comparable to their peers, they need to provide this type of information, and obviously users will be asking them for this type of information. So you sometimes would find this information even in companies that are listed in jurisdictions which are not requiring it. And then to Siobhan's point, I think what the research demonstrates is that there is a lot of variation in actually the specific type of information that's required, from the very detailed type of information that's required in some jurisdictions to sort of maybe more summary information, and even just some specific things that just vary between jurisdictions. And I think that's what the paper is just trying to demonstrate, that there is this variety out there in terms of the requirements. I mean, just using one as an example, in oil and gas, in Australia, they require proved and probable reserves to be disclosed, and they allow you to disclose on a voluntary basis contingent resources. Whereas in the US, in oil and gas, they require you to disclose your proved reserves, and they would allow you, so on a voluntary basis, to disclose probable and possible reserves. So there's just, I think the paper tries to demonstrate that there is just a large variety of requirements out there in terms of the depth they go to and just then the specific requirements. But to your point, Daryl, I think there is also just a balance to this as well, in that some companies may well volunteer their information anyway, even if regulatory requirements in their jurisdiction doesn't specifically require it.
Mary?
Okay. A couple things, reactions to this paper. So today's paper focuses on disclosures that are largely, I'll say, supplemental to financial statements. And I think you're going to come back to us another day with the disclosures about accounting policies for exploration and evaluation, which is the inside the financial statements. Okay. So today, a couple of cautions about disclosures and focusing on disclosures. If today they are, I think, largely supplemental to the financial statements rather than seen as part of the financial statements, I think one of the questions that I would want the staff to analyze is, are they more kind of, thinking about this morning's discussion, management commentary type information, or do they really support financial statements? Now, in this instance, I've got to believe that virtually any reserve, resource, has some cost associated with it that has been reported in the financial statements, but the cost may have very little relationship with the value. Because, it's going to depend on how effective you are, how efficient you are, and how lucky you are. And I think that luck probably plays a piece in that. If we thought about these disclosures in relation to what is recognized and measured in the financial statements, it is not a disaggregation of cost information. It is detail about what underlies something that has a cost representation in the financial statements. And there are different ways of doing the cost information. And I'm kind of philosophizing about this because I think one of the questions that I'd like you to think about is whether we are looking at disclosure as a potentially missing element from financial statements, that the information that is necessary for the financial statements to be useful, even if it does not relate to the cost that is directly to the cost that is recognized, or if we're looking at it as something that users find very useful and want to have, but it's a supplement to the financial statement. So that's one question, and that kind of comes back to understanding why today many of these disclosures seem to be outside rather than inside financial statements. The second thing that it would be helpful if you could think about when you bring an analysis back to us is, on the one hand, I think the paper is showing a very, and I think both Daryl and Tim commented on this, very helpful kind of convergence towards a couple of increasingly globally recognized and used frameworks. On the other hand, the staff comment is that that significant diversity in practice remains within these kind of converging frameworks. And my first question is, can you help us understand why we have both convergence and remaining diversity in practice? If it is because the frameworks are so high level that it's possible for a very wide range of practices to claim compliance, then I think you need to tell us that. And then my first question, and that's relevant to my first question, because I think if we're thinking about putting especially something in financial statements, we need to understand the degree of specificity. It may be more because, any measurement of value requires entity-specific assumptions about cost to remove or process, or, you know, depending upon what the resource is. And if that's it, then can we, you know, and they may have very different assumptions about what things cost, both based on the physical attributes of the location, but also based on their methodologies. Is that an instance in which we can overcome, you know, we can address diversity by having disclosures of what the assumptions are? And I would consider it comparable, even if we had two entities with very different inputs, if those reflected physical attributes of sites or their cost structure or methodology, et cetera, for how they extracted. You know, that's fine, and that's what's brought out in the disclosure. And then the third thing I wanted to mention, it's a caution rather than a no way statement, is I'm very cautious about baking into IFRS standards frameworks that are set by a body external to us. So to the extent the staff is thinking about a recommendation that involves incorporating existing frameworks, just think about that concern about how that's maintained on an ongoing basis and how we would, let's say, deal with application questions. So that's something I'd ask you to think about. So thank you for the report. Those are three areas I wanted to ask you to think about in a follow-up.
Thank you, Mary. Tadal?
Thank you, Sue. Just 2 points. One, the relationship between reserves and resources with the financial statements. And on paragraph 15, we give some examples of this information being used for impairment testing, depreciation, when the unit of production is used. But I would also add, for example, discount of obligations related to employee benefit, decommission, restoration, because the time length of the exploration. In case of a business combination involving these type of entities, it has impact on the purchase price allocation, subsequent measurement. When we are assessing capitalization of exploration and evaluation costs, as the reserves and resources has a direct impact on the feasibility assessment. I mean, that definitely when we talk about reserves and resources, we already have a lot of assumptions that are used for measuring numbers in the financial statements. That's what I'm trying to say, that very much in line what Jing Chao and Mary said, is that these resources and reserves are very important to keep transparency and consistent in relation to the financial statements as well. It's not just a supplementary information. These are very important assumptions currently for the financial statements. And a second point that I'd like to make is in relation to independent experts. That's always something that comes to my mind when you have something in the financial statements that are quite complicated and definitely is not in the accountant's hand. Someone else with very good experience on what they are reporting should be involved. And then looking at how can I assure that the information that we have in financial statements is good or not? We discuss about independent experts. Despite we on paragraph 20b, it states that some jurisdiction requires the competent person responsible for the information to be independent. But when I look at the nine jurisdictions that were referred to in the end of this paper, I just saw one actually referring to independent expert. But I think that this is something that we will likely have to discuss, whether it is our, as standard setting, our call, or actually it should be very much driven by local legislation. These are the 2 points for follow-up. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anne?
Thanks, Sue. A couple of points. The first point is this diversity that you've talked to us about and reported on in the paper. Does it matter for users of the financial statements? So in You tell us that people rely, investors, users rely on the financial statements. The information provided is diverse. Some of it, it is outside the financial statements. For some entities, it's not public information, and so it lacks comparability and consistency. Your conclusion in paragraph 30, section B, is all those things can affect users' understanding of entities. So my question to you is, what are you going to do as you go forward? You've given us a very useful and helpful list in paper 19 of summarising what you've already brought and what's coming. My question is, to what extent are you going to be able to give us more information about what user needs are in response to this diversity? You've given us this high-level statement in this paper. I don't know if you know more, and I don't know if you have plans to find out more for us, to help us, because to me this is a crucial part of the question. When you bring us the scope paper and we have to make decisions, I'd like to know more about whether the diversity matters for users, because sometimes users get themselves in a position where they work around the limitations of the financial statements, and they have ways of doing this, and they're quite comfortable with the ways they're using. So that was my first question. The second question or comment, it's quite on another matter altogether. I just wonder if you could give us the little bit of background on reserve recognition accounting, because I think that was actually considered at one point in the US. I might be wrong, but I think it was actually proposed and considered whether there'd be recognition of reserves. We haven't talked about that at all, but I think it's important that board members have an understanding that has actually been discussed at some stage previously, and it's pertinent to this topic. The other thing on that vein was, you've talked to us about and given us a lot of data about the frameworks that are currently being used and where and how it's working. I did think about that framework we heard about, and Tim knows about this. It was from, I was going to say World Bank, but not World Bank. Tim, we have had a present. Siobhan, you want to say, do you?
Yeah.
United Nations. Yeah.
United Nations, yeah. We're looking as is. I'm saying, can we also have that little bit of history on that topic, reserve recognition accounting in the US, but also this alternative? I don't know where they've got to. It's probably 18 months since we heard from them on their fabulous new proposal around disclosure of resources reserves. So I just like that's in the picture as well. Thank you.
Just to answer your first question on user feedback, so far what we are hearing is that users find it useful, but we're our next step is to try and do some outreach with some, I guess, expert users who actually do use this information on a daily basis, so we can get a better understanding of what's going on. And then that will be included in our scoping analysis for you at a later date. With regards to your second question about reserve recognition accounting, because at this point, we're only looking at activities that are within the scope of IFRS 6, which is just exploration and evaluation. We have not considered reserve accounting at this stage, because once you have a reserve, you are outside the scope of IFRS 6, or you would be operating outside the scope of IFRS 6. I think Tim can talk a bit more about our plans for that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that maybe when we think about the scoping, because it's something that, you know, could be an option that the board does want to have a look at as part of the project. That would obviously, as Siobhan says, widen the scope of the project from what we're looking at the moment. But that's the question that we'll be asking the board, which is actually what do they think the right scope is for this project? And so we can maybe gather some information for that as we pull some of the information together from the scoping. And to your first question, as Siobhan says, yes, I mean, when we come back with the scoping information, we'll sort of bring back and try to bring everything together. And what we're trying to bring back together is some of the user feedback that we've heard. But as Siobhan says, we're trying to talk to investors, because obviously this is really important to understand exactly what the problem is in terms of reserve and resource reporting, what barriers and challenges they're finding in terms of the information, if they are. And that's similar to the accounting policy diversity question as well. That question to users as to, is that really important information for you, that diversity? And we'll talk about that in a subsequent meeting. So we're going to be talking with the investor engagement team to try to reach out to users in the interim period before we come back with the scoping discussion.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Could I make sure everybody who's not speaking just mutes, because it's quite noisy on my side. Nick, I think you're next.
Thank you. Just sort of thinking about the discussion, I think Tadil was right to highlight that reserves and resources drive many aspects of the financial statements. But in terms of the value drivers for the sector, from a share price perspective, from what I understand and from what we hear, it's actually the value of those reserves in particular that drive those share prices, and not so much the financial statements. And partly that's because of the reasons that Mary alluded to. You, in the financial statements, we reflect some of the costs around these projects, and clearly they have I think the correlation between particular levels of costs and the value impact of resource discoveries, for instance, is limited. And so the drivers of sales share prices is simply that largely the value of reserves and resources. I was also interested in the debate earlier on. I can't remember who made the comments, but seeking to differentiate between, I think it may have been Tim actually, between the requirements and what's actually reported. And clearly this is an area of the market where capital does flow internationally, and very clearly flows internationally. And I remember a very public disconnect between two major oil companies within the last 10 years, where suddenly investors and the press alighted on a difference in reserve data, and the two companies were effectively forced, or the one who wasn't providing such full information was effectively forced to move into line with the fuller disclosure of the other entity. So I think there's a real issue there. And again, just I think in line with what Anne said, just to encourage again to try and extend our engagement with users in this field, because I think we will need to be careful in terms of how we consider taking this project forward, and not really expanding beyond necessarily the remit of what we traditionally think of financial statement disclosure here. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. Rika?
Thank you, Sue. I probably have a similar view with what Nick and Mary said. I think the regulator have their own objective to require the entity to disclose the specific matters for their purpose, not necessarily that relates to financial information. So as a next step, I'm really interested in what information is really necessary for the user of the financial statement to assess the reserve and resources as a source of the future cash flow, as well as the possible risk that can be incurred, the cost, significant cost in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Rika. Tim, did you want to say something before we wrap up the discussion?
Yeah, just a couple of things. I mean, to one of the comments that we heard, Mary's concern, in fact, on incorporating a third-party system into our standards, into IFRS standards. I mean, that is certainly feedback, consistent with feedback that was heard on the 2010 discussion paper, when the discussion paper talked about incorporating classification systems into an IFRS standard on extractives, and so it's an important point to consider, and it's obviously something that, you know, we'll consider further as we go through the scoping exercise. And I guess the other thing I was just going to mention really is, and again, we'll maybe talk about it a little bit more in the scoping exercise, but if the board does decide that it wants to pursue exploring reserve and resource reporting within this project, obviously I think we would need to probably get some more specialised outside input, because I mean, certainly from my perspective, I don't have enough detailed knowledge. I have a superficial knowledge of reserve and resource reporting, but I think we would need some expert outside input. And I think, in fact, when they did the discussion paper back in 2010, they had an expert working group. That's just something that we would maybe have to bear in mind. And actually, I think as a suggestion from the board at a previous meeting when we were talking around this subject, is the other thing we would need to think about is maybe engaging regulators as well in this particular area, given the reporting requirements that are there in local jurisdictions that we've been outlining today. That was all I was going to say.
Okay, thank you. So hopefully staff's got what they need. More things to go away and think about. So thank you very much. So that brings our technical discussions for the September meeting to a close. Before we go, I just wanted to say a couple of things. I know you're all expecting me to farewell one person, but I'm actually going to farewell two people. But don't worry, it's not that anybody hasn't got a message that they should have received, that they're being booted off the table. It's an unusual farewell. Usually we farewell people who are at the table. Today I'm going to first farewell somebody who would definitely be in the room in normal times, isn't in the room today because of the virtual meeting. And that's one of our long-term stakeholders, Alan Close, who represents ACLI. I understand he's been observing our board meetings, usually in person, since 2002. So he's been near the table longer than all of us. And he's been a really helpful resource for us in the insurance project. He reads all of the board papers, not just insurance ones. And just a special shout out, I'm sure he's listening, to say thank you for all the help he's given us over the years, providing us with input on our projects and in the field work on insurance as well. So sorry we can't say goodbye in person, but you've been a great supporter. Then moving on to the farewell of the really sad farewell, the one at the table, the virtual table at least. That is, of course, Daryl, who has been a board member for 10 years, and this is his last board meeting. We're still going to make him work until the end of next week, but this is his last board meeting. And maybe just a few observations from my side. Always a risk that it's not the observations Daryl will want me to make, but when I think of Daryl, what do I think of? So firstly, a very strong, came to the board with a very strong preparer background, and I think he's always been very helpful, providing us with balanced feedback about the practical effects of what we're proposing, and provided us with that input. But not only a preparer input, he's certainly got a very balanced view. If I think about the things that I think that come to mind when I think about Daryl, of course he can't escape the fact that he's very closely associated with IFRS 17. He's become one of the very notable voices on our insurance project, for better or for worse. He's also been very much a supporter of the initiatives that we've got in the SME space. He's very well known in the SME community. And more recently, of course, he's been very closely involved with the Rate Reg project. The other notable thing for me with Daryl is sometimes when I ask board members if they're willing to travel somewhere, they sort of look at me and take a breath before they respond. I think Daryl is my most enthusiastic person when it comes to travel offers. I think he's probably about the most well-travelled of our board members, perhaps even more travelled than Hans, because he loves travelling and he was always up to travel wherever we wanted him to go. So that's been really, really helpful. He's also fantastic at outreach and public speaking. As many of you will have seen at our conferences and other outreach settings, he's really got a gift for presenting things, clearly and in an entertaining and engaging way. He's really, really great at outreach. So I myself have enjoyed watching him present from time to time. And not only is he a great board member who's really helped us move projects forward, and as I'm sure I'm not the only board member who's going to be really, really sad not to have Daryl still a member of the board going forward, I know that the staff really love working with Daryl, and I know that because I used to be on the staff and because I talk to the staff a lot. And I think the thing that Daryl really spends time on that maybe not everybody appreciates, and certainly not the people listening to the webcast, is just how much time he spends with the staff, both providing them with input on technical work. He is a person who will roll up his sleeves without hesitation and really get involved to help you get a project over the line. But also, I know he's a fantastic mentor for many members of the staff. He's really generous with his time and his input, helping them with ideas on their career development and giving them really detailed and constructive feedback. He's not the person that's going to tell you you're fantastic at everything, but he is the person who's going to give you really wise counsel to really try and help you in your career. And I know that the organization's going to miss that aspect of your personality. So thank you, Daryl. It's been a real pleasure and an honor working with you at the board. I'm going to get emotional in a minute. But before I do that, Daryl, I'm going to hand to you to see if you wanted to say anything before we give you a big round of applause. So, Daryl.
Thank you, Sue. Thanks, Sue. And thank you for that. It was equally from my side quite difficult not to become emotional around that. I think we're probably going to have a few discussions between now and next week when I go, so I won't go into too much, but I do think there's a useful opportunity maybe to make a couple of comments, and I think your comments about Alan Close are maybe a little bit on point. I don't think I realized coming into this position just how active and diligent and positive our stakeholder engagement really is as an organization. And I think I particularly hadn't realized how much work the stakeholders, the people we outreach with, all of those who are providing us insight into the various aspects of the project, and Tim's just referred to some a few minutes ago, just how much work they put into it. And I know we couldn't do the job we do without that input. I also know, and the IFRS 17 experience is perhaps particularly relevant here, that because we seek to provide a balanced output, it means that we don't always produce the exact standard that a particular stakeholder wants us to produce. And clearly we make compromises between our different stakeholders. But I think it's just important to put the message out there to everybody who's been involved in the process that the standards we produce are better because of all of those people, and just maybe compliment all of those who've contributed over the years that I've been at the board. And then the one other thing I just wanted to say is that the board and the incredible staff we have at the foundation, I just think a more hardworking, talented, knowledgeable, and perhaps in particular opinionated bunch of people would be hard to find. And I've appreciated throughout my time at the board the fact that we've had some real debates, some real discussions, that people have come in to most of these discussions with very strong views, but have also been prepared to change their minds. And I think that's where the strength of the organization comes from, is we both talk and listen. We have views, but we're prepared to change those views. So finally, it's been an awesome, and I'm very, very proud to have been associated with this organization for the last 10 years. Thank you.
Thank you. And so I ask you to unmute your machine and give Daryl a round of applause.
In case anybody thinks their screen needs to be adjusted, it doesn't. I am blushing.
And on that note, thank you very much. That brings to an end the September board meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, bye, everyone. Bye. Bye.